Imagine building a machine that costs $2 trillion.
That's a number that's almost hard to even picture.
Right. And then imagine that this $2 trillion machine frequently breaks down. It is vastly over budget, and well, half the time, you can barely even use it for its primary purpose.
In any normal business sector, if you spearheaded a project like that, you'd be fired immediately.
Exactly. I mean, the company might even go bankrupt. But in the defense industry, you are rewarded with a permanent monopoly, your funding gets increased, and your product becomes, politically immortal.
It completely defies standard market logic.
It really does. And today, we are looking at exactly why that happens. Welcome to the deep dive.
And the entry point for the source material we are examining today is, well, it's a fascinating, incredibly dense 2026 draft of a book titled The Military-Industrial Complex.
It's a massive read, and we're unpacking this manuscript because it presents a really intense, dual-layered thesis about how the modern world actually operates. So the first layer claims that a highly concentrated defense industry actively profits from keeping the globe in a state of perpetual war.
Right, which honestly might not shock you.
No, I think a lot of people suspect that. But the second layer, this is where it takes a massive leap. The authors claim that this exact same industry has suppressed, recovered, non-human post-scarcity technology for 80 years.
Yeah, that's the part that really turns everything upside down.
Right. And they argue that they haven't hidden it to protect us from some, cosmic threat. They've hidden it specifically to protect their own profit margins.
Before we go down this rabbit hole, let's just establish some ground rules for how we are analyzing this.
Good idea.
Because this manuscript touches on massive institutional accusations, highly sensitive geopolitical history, and claims that, frankly, trigger intense reactions across the political spectrum.
Oh, definitely. People get very heated about this.
Exactly. So our role here is entirely neutral. We aren't endorsing these viewpoints, nor are we here to debunk them. Our job is simply to act as your guides through the text. We're going to examine the paper trail, unpack the physics and the bureaucracy, and just lay out the internal logic the authors use to build their case.
We are just mapping the territory for you. Okay, let's unpack this. To really understand this book, you have to grasp the foundational concept the authors use as a lens for the entire 20th and 21st centuries. They call it an accounting identity.
Accounting identity, right.
Let's break that down because it sounds like a very dry, finance term. But it's actually the brutal engine of this whole theory.
It really is.
An accounting identity essentially means an inequality that must be true by definition. So if your company's core revenue model relies on manufacturing and selling weapons, your company inevitably does better financially when those weapons are destroyed on a battlefield and need to be replaced.
What's fascinating here is how it strips all the romance and ideology right out of global conflict.
Yeah, it really does.
I mean, we are taught to view history as a series of great moral struggles, right? Democracy versus tyranny, freedom versus oppression.
Sure, the good guys and the bad guys.
Exactly. But the authors ask you to set all of that aside and just look at the ledger. If you manufacture umbrellas, your business requires rain. If you manufacture missiles, your business requires conflict.
It's so simple when you put it like that.
And you do not need a shadowy cabal of comic book villains plotting in a smoke-filled room to create endless wars. You simply need a system where the financial incentives of the most powerful corporations are perfectly aligned with continuous armed conflict.
Right. It's less like a smoke-filled room of comic book villains and more like a casino. Nobody has to actively conspire for the house to win, you know? The rules are just built that way. Rational actors just doing their jobs and maximizing shareholder value will naturally push the world toward war.
Exactly. And what makes this argument so compelling right out of the gate is who the authors use to prove it.
Yeah, let's talk about the sources they bring up.
They don't start with anonymous whistleblowers or internet forums. They start with the most decorated, deeply embedded military men of the 20th century.
Like Smedley D. Butler.
Yes, Smedley D. Butler.
A lot of people might not know that name, but at the time of his death, Major General Smedley D. Butler was the most decorated Marine in United States history. He had two Medals of Honor.
Two of them. That's incredibly rare.
Right. And he spent over 30 years leading military interventions across the Caribbean and Central America during what were called the Banana Wars.
And in 1935, after retiring, Butler wrote a short book called War is a Racket. The language he uses in it is astonishing for a man of his rank.
It really is. He explicitly wrote, and I quote, I was a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers.
A muscle man.
Yeah, he even called himself a gangster for capitalism. He outlined how his deployments were rarely about national security. They were about securing foreign markets for American fruit companies, oil interests, and banks.
And the manuscript uses Butler to establish that the concept of the military acting as a violent enforcement arm for corporate profit, well, it's not a modern fringe theory. It was articulated by the Marine Corps top brass nearly a century ago.
The book also details Butler's involvement in uncovering the business plot of 1934. Wall Street figures allegedly approached Butler, trying to recruit him to lead an army of veterans to overthrow President Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Overthrow the president?
Yeah.
To install a fascist government more friendly to corporate interests.
Exactly. And he blew the whistle to Congress. Now, historians still debate the operational seriousness of that plot, but the authors use it to highlight a shift in the burden of proof.
Right.
When a two-time Medal of Honor recipient says the war business is a racket manipulated by financiers, you can't just dismiss it as anti-war hysteria.
You really can't. It forces you to look at the mechanics of the system, which brings the manuscript to a much more famous warning. President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address on January 17, 1961.
Oh, yeah. This is the speech where the specific phrase military-industrial complex was introduced to the public lexicon.
Exactly. And people quote that speech all the time, but the context is what the book really leans into. Eisenhower wasn't a civilian academic theorizing about defense spending.
No, not at all. He was a five-star general.
The supreme Allied commander who orchestrated the invasion of Normandy.
Right. He oversaw the largest mechanized slaughter in human history. And then he served 8 years as a Republican president at the height of the Cold War.
He had more intimate knowledge of the American war machine than any living human. And in his final moments of national attention, he didn't warn the country about the Soviets.
Which is what you expect in 1961.
Exactly. Instead, he warned the American public about the domestic threat of the military-industrial complex acquiring unwarranted influence. He also explicitly warned that public policy could become the captive of a scientific-technological elite.
A scientific-technological elite.
Yes. He had seen the Manhattan Project. He saw how extreme secrecy, combined with unlimited funding and advanced physics, could create an unaccountable power structure completely severed from democratic oversight.
So the book takes Eisenhower's warning and applies a sociological framework to it, bringing in C. Wright Mills, who wrote The Power Elite in 1956.
Yes, Mills is crucial here.
Mills described this interlocking directorate of corporate, military, and political leaders. But let's ground that concept for a second. What does an interlocking directorate actually look like in practice?
Well, it looks like the revolving door.
Okay.
It's the bureaucrat who writes the requirements for a new defense contract, then retires from the Pentagon and immediately takes a seven-figure seat on the board of directors of the exact defense contractor that won the bid.
Wow.
And then a few years later, they are appointed to a high-level cabinet position where they decide foreign policy, which, of course, determines how many weapons that contractor needs to build.
That's wild. So the manuscript argues that this isn't corruption in the traditional sense, like a bribe in a briefcase?
No, it is structural fusion. The people writing the checks, the people cashing the checks, and the people creating the need for the checks are entirely interchangeable.
Which brings up a critical historical pivot. If this permanent war economy was churning along during the Cold War, justified by the existential threat of the Soviet Union, what happens in 1991?
Right, the end of the Cold War.
The Berlin Wall falls. Mm. The Soviet Union collapses. Peace breaks out.
Mm.
By standard market logic, the defense industry should have shrunk massively. The peace dividend, right?
That is precisely the test case the authors use. If the defense industry was a normal free market sector responding to demand, the sudden evaporation of their primary adversary should have caused massive downsizing and diversification.
But it didn't.
No. Instead, the exact opposite occurred, and it was triggered by a pivotal 1993 event known in the industry as the Last Supper.
Okay, I've heard this term thrown around. The Last Supper, it sounds like, I don't know, dramatic Pentagon lore. Was there an actual dinner where they just carved up the market?
It was a very real dinner. In 1993, then Deputy Secretary of Defense William Perry invited the CEOs of the major aerospace and defense contractors to the Pentagon.
Okay.
At the time, there were roughly 51 major prime contractors. Perry essentially told them that the Department of Defense could no longer sustain that many distinct companies in a post-Cold War budget environment. He explicitly encouraged them to consolidate.
Wait, really? So instead of letting the free market naturally weed out the inefficient companies, the government basically ordered a monopoly building exercise.
They absolutely did. And the book tracks the results. Those 51 companies collapsed down to just five giant primes that dominate today.
Lockheed Martin, RTX, which is Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and General Dynamics.
The manuscript breaks down the specific subsectors to show how extreme this got. Tactical missile suppliers went from 13 down to 3. Fixed-wing aircraft manufacturers went from 8 to 3.
That's a massive consolidation.
When the Soviet threat disappeared, the market didn't shrink. It consolidated its power. The government voluntarily surrendered its ability to foster competitive bidding. The authors argue this is the textbook definition of regulatory capture. The customer, the United States government, became entirely dependent on a cartel.
And the data they use to back up this capture is staggering. Let me read you some of these numbers from the source material.
Go ahead.
In a recent five-year window, roughly 80% of retired four-star generals and admirals went straight to work for the arms sector. 80%.
It's an incredible statistic.
And between 2008 and 2018, over 380 senior Department of Defense officials moved to defense contractors. We are talking about a system where the primary goal of a military procurement officer's career is to secure a lucrative job with the company they're supposed to be negotiating against.
And you see this power reflected in the lobbying data, too. In 2024 alone, the defense sector spent $159.2 million on federal lobbying. Since 2001, it's over $2.5 billion. Year after year, the single most lobbied piece of legislation is the National Defense Authorization Act, the bill that literally dictates their revenue.
Which leads us right back to the machine we talked about at the top of the show, the F-35 Lightning II fighter jet.
The ultimate archetype of this captured system.
Exactly. It is a program with a projected lifetime cost of roughly $2 trillion. That includes procurement and sustainment through 2088. But here is the mechanism that makes it brilliant. How do you protect a $2 trillion program that is plagued by cost overruns and performance issues?
You engineer its supply chain to be political armor.
Yes. The F-35 isn't built in one massive factory. Its supply chain is intentionally fractured across roughly 1,900 suppliers located in practically every single U.S. state.
It's a gerrymandered political map.
That's the perfect way to put it. The supply chain is built like a gerrymandered political map. If a reform-minded politician looks at the F-35 and says, you know, this is way over budget, the software is a mess, we need to cancel it, well, they aren't just voting against a plane.
No, they are voting to destroy thousands of high-paying manufacturing jobs in their own congressional district.
And in the districts of their colleagues. It becomes politically radioactive to oppose it. The F-35's greatest defense mechanism isn't stealth, it's job distribution in congressional districts.
And the manuscript makes a chilling point here. From the perspective of the F-35 program managers, the air crash isn't a failure. It's the greatest success in the history of the accounting identity.
Because it just keeps generating money.
Exactly. It costs more the worse it performs, generating endless contracts for upgrades and sustainment, all while being completely immune to cancellation.
And then the book zooms out from a single aircraft to the macro ledger of the last 20 years. Using data from Brown University's Costs of War project, they look at the post-9/11 era. Over 900,000 direct deaths from war violence, tens of millions displaced, and a total U.S. budgetary cost of around $8
trillion. $8 trillion.
Let's just pause on that. That number is so large, the human brain can't really process it. If you spent $1 million a day, every single day, since the birth of Christ, you wouldn't even hit $1 trillion. And yet $8 trillion was absorbed into the system.
And out of that unimaginable sum, the top five prime contractors absorbed $771 billion just in the years between 2020 and 2024 alone.
It's hard to even fathom.
The authors use this as their baseline reality check. You do not need to introduce aliens or recovered technology yet. You just have to look at the public ledger. A highly concentrated, heavily lobbied industry made almost incomprehensible fortunes from two decades of conflict that achieved highly questionable strategic results, but reliably delivered maximum shareholder value.
Okay, play devil's advocate for a second. We do see defense contractors get busted sometimes. We see headlines about companies paying massive fines for overcharging the government.
Right.
We see procurement officials indicted for fraud. So doesn't that prove the oversight system works? If it's a totally captured monopoly, why do they let themselves get caught?
The authors anticipate that exact pushback, and they introduce a concept they call the decoy.
The decoy?
Yes. It operates much like a casino catching a card counter. If a casino catches a guy skimming chips, they make a big public show of kicking him out. It proves to the Gaming Commission and the other players that the games are fair and closely watched.
Oh, I see.
Meanwhile, the House is mathematically guaranteed to take everyone's money through the fundamental rules of the games themselves.
So a $615 million tanker scandal, or, you know, a colonel going to jail for accepting a petty kickback, that is the decoy corruption. It's the corruption you were allowed to see.
Exactly. The decoy gives the press and the public the illusion of rigorous oversight. The watchdogs get to claim a victory. But it is a systemic sleight of hand. By focusing all the investigative energy on traditional, manageable procurement fraud, the system perfectly distracts from the actual, unaudited, multi-decade secrets.
Secrets hidden entirely outside the normal appropriations process.
The manuscript explicitly warns the reader, do not let the ordinary corruption hold your eye.
So if the public is distracted by decoy crimes, where is the real money and the real power actually hiding? This leads us directly to the container built to hold the ultimate secrets, the black budget.
And the manuscript traces the legal foundation of the secrecy apparatus back to a single monumental piece of legislation, the National Security Act of 1947. To understand the modern world, you have to understand this law. It created the CIA, the National Security Council, an independent Air Force, and unified the military under the Department of Defense. But more importantly, it established the legal and bureaucratic machinery for permanent, entirely unauditable classified programs.
We hear the phrase black budget in spy movies, but we need to ground this in reality.
Okay.
How does a special access program, or SAP, actually work? Like, if I'm a sitting U.S. senator on the Armed Services Committee, I hold the purse strings, can I just demand to see the books?
Not at all.
Really?
That is the genius of the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
A special access program operates on a strict need-to-know basis managed by what is called a bigot list.
Wait, a bigot list?
Yes. It's a literal list of the only individuals cleared to know the program even exists. And it goes deeper than that. There are unacknowledged SAPs. And even waived unacknowledged SAPs.
Waived meaning what, exactly?
In a waived program, the Secretary of Defense or the President can legally waive the requirement to brief the full congressional oversight committees. They only have to brief the Gang of Eight, the top congressional leaders, and even then, only verbally.
Just verbally, no documents.
There is no paper trail provided. Congress is essentially funding tens of billions of dollars a year in dark matter. They know the total mass of the budget, but they cannot see the individual particles.
So how do you investigate a system designed to be legally invisible? The authors establish a golden rule for the reader to navigate this secrecy. They say, cost is credibility.
Cost is credibility.
Right. Trust the whistleblowers who paid a massive personal and professional price to expose the truth and heavily distrust the institutions that profit from the silence.
The book divides these whistleblowers into categories, starting with the cost tellers. These are the people who tried to expose the mundane financial reality of the black budget.
Like A. Ernest Fitzgerald.
Yes, perfect example.
In 1968, he was a senior Air Force financial manager. He discovered a massive $2.3 billion cost overrun on the Lockheed C-5A transport plane.
And he didn't just run to the press. He did what you're supposed to do. He went through internal channels. He tried to get the bureaucracy to fix the accounting error.
But the bureaucracy didn't want to fix it. Eventually, he was subpoenaed by Congress, and against direct orders from his superiors, he told the truth about the $2.3 billion. And what was his reward? President Richard Nixon personally ordered him fired.
Just fired on the spot.
Yep. Fitzgerald had to spend years and his own fortune in legal fees fighting all the way to the Supreme Court just to get his job back.
Then you have Chuck Spinney, a Pentagon systems analyst. In 1980, he produced a meticulous briefing called Defense Facts of Life. He proved mathematically that the Pentagon was deliberately buying overly complex weapons based on total fantasy financial assumptions, guaranteeing endless budget shortfalls.
And his superiors actively tried to bury the report.
They did. When he finally testified to Congress, putting his face on the cover of Time magazine, by the way, the Pentagon retaliated by isolating him and freezing his career. These men were not anti-government radicals. They were loyal accountants trying to save taxpayer money.
Here's where it gets really interesting. When you move from the cost tellers to the surveillance tellers, the retaliation gets even darker. We all know Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1971.
He exposed that the government had been systematically lying about the viability of the Vietnam War.
For that, he faced 115 years in prison under the Espionage Act. And the White House literally dispatched operatives to burglarize his psychiatrist's office looking for blackmail material.
staggering. But the manuscript focuses heavily on Thomas Drake and William Dinney to explain the modern bureaucratic trap.
Right.
These were highly decorated senior officials at the NSA. After 9/11, they tried to use internal channels to stop a mass surveillance program called Trailblazer. The issue wasn't just that Trailblazer was unconstitutionally spying on Americans. It's that Trailblazer was a multi-billion dollar boondoggle that didn't work. Binney and Drake had built a cheaper, more effective, and privacy-compliant alternative called ThinThread.
Let me stop you right there, because this is the core of the accounting identity. Why would the NSA choose the multi-billion dollar program that doesn't work over the cheap program that does?
Because of the incentives. A cheap in-house program doesn't generate massive contracts for the primes. It doesn't allow NSA directors to retire and join the boards of the companies building the software.
Well,
ThinThread was killed because it was too efficient. And when Drake and Binney tried to report this to the Defense Department Inspector General following the exact legal whistleblower process, what happened? Binney was raided by the FBI at gunpoint while he was in the shower. Drake was indicted under the Espionage Act.
That is horrifying.
His career was destroyed, he went bankrupt, and he ended up working at an Apple store. The felony case eventually collapsed because it was baseless intimidation, but the message was sent.
And the manuscript doesn't stop at ruined careers. It looks at the dead and ruined. People who got too close to the core secrets and ended up dead under highly disputed circumstances.
People like Gary Webb.
Yeah, the journalist who exposed the CIA's links to the crack cocaine epidemic to fund Nicaraguan Contras. His career was systematically destroyed by a coordinated smear campaign, and he was later found dead with two gunshot wounds to the head, which was officially ruled a suicide.
Two gunshots. The book also details Frank Olson, an Army CIA scientist. He began having severe moral reservations about biological weapons programs. In 1953, the CIA secretly dosed him with LSD during a retreat as part of the MKUltra mind control experiments.
And then days later, he supposedly jumped through a closed window on the 13th floor of a New York hotel. His family spent decades fighting the official narrative, eventually exhuming his body to find blunt force trauma that predated the fall.
And Karen Silkwood, a chemical technician at a plutonium plant who discovered falsified safety records. In 1974, she was driving to meet a New York Times reporter with a folder full of documentary evidence.
He ever made it?
No. Her car was forced off the road, she died in the crash, and the folder of evidence mysteriously vanished from the wreckage. Now, the authors are careful here. They state you don't have to believe every single one of these was a blatant assassination, but you have to look at the undeniable pattern.
The pattern is the point. In a healthy institution, finding a $2.3 billion error gets you a promotion. In this system, it gets you fired. The manuscript argues that the national security state acts exactly like an aggressive biological immune system.
A biological immune system?
Yes. It does not have morals. It doesn't care about the Constitution or taxpayer efficiency. It only cares about neutralizing any foreign entity that threatens the survival and expansion of the host body. And when you put yourself in the shoes of someone discovering a massive truth, would you step forward if the historical precedent was professional and personal ruin?
It manufactures its own leakers. Edward Snowden explicitly stated that he bypassed the proper internal channels and went straight to journalists, specifically because he watched the system utterly destroy Thomas Drake and William Binney when they tried to play by the rules. The system broke the social contract first.
Exactly. So if the system is willing to destroy people over cost overruns and illegal surveillance, what happens when an insider tries to expose the ultimate secret hidden in that 1947 black budget?
This is where we cross the threshold into the second layer of the thesis, the vault and the recovered craft. The assertion that the United States government, via these unaccountable private contractors, has spent decades reverse engineering non-human technology.
And the book grounds this right back in 1947, the exact same year the National Security Act built the secrecy apparatus. The Roswell incident.
Now, everyone has cultural baggage regarding Roswell. Little green men, tinfoil hats. The authors ask you to strip all that away and look strictly at the documented public relations behavior of the U.S. military.
Okay, let's look at it.
On July 8, 1947, the Roswell Army Airfield issued an official on-the-record press release stating they had recovered a flying disc.
Which is an insane thing for a military base to accidentally publish if it isn't true.
Precisely. And within 24 hours, they retracted it. The news story was that it was just a weather balloon.
Right, the classic weather balloon.
Decades later, in 1994, under public pressure, the Air Force changed the story again. They said it wasn't a weather balloon at all. It was a highly classified acoustic detection balloon designed to monitor Soviet nuclear tests called Project Mogul.
Okay, that sounds plausible. A classified balloon crashes. You say it's a weather balloon to hide it.
It does sound plausible. Until 1997, when the Air Force issued a fourth explanation to address the witness reports of bodies at the crash site. They published a report claiming the aliens people saw were actually anthropomorphic crash test dummies dropped from high-altitude balloons.
But wait, the authors point out a massive, glaring chronological error here. The military's crash test dummy program didn't even begin until 1953. They were off by 6 years.
Right.
The military literally had to invent a psychological theory they called time compression to explain why witnesses in 1947 were supposedly having false memories of test dummies that didn't exist until the Eisenhower administration.
The manuscript uses this timeline to prove a simple point. The military's explanations are documented fabrications. You don't need to know exactly what crashed to know that the institution engaged in a multi-generational cover-up, repeatedly lying to the public when secrecy was deemed more important than truth.
Which opens the door for the whistleblowers who claim to know what was actually covered up. The book brings in Colonel Philip Corso. In 1997, he published The Day After Roswell.
Corso wasn't a fringe guy. He served on the National Security Council under Eisenhower and ran the Foreign Technology Desk in Army Research and Development at the Pentagon.
Yeah, a very serious career.
He claimed that his actual job was taking artifacts recovered from the Roswell crash and others and quietly funneling them to major defense contractors to be reverse engineered. He specifically claimed that foundational modern technologies like fiber optics, lasers, and integrated circuits were seeded from this non-human craft.
Now, how does a bureaucrat seed alien tech? He claimed he would take a piece of the material, bring it to a lab like Bell Labs, and say, we recovered this from a foreign adversary. We don't know how it works. Figure it out and patent it.
The book acknowledges that historians and critics have picked apart some of Corso's timelines or suggested he inflated his personal importance. But the authors argue that the specific details of an old soldier's memoir are secondary to the core structural claim.
That recovered exotic technology is deliberately laundered into the private defense industry to bypass government oversight, because a private company isn't subject to the Freedom of Information Act.
Which brings the narrative to the most polarizing figure in this entire history, Bob Lazar.
Bob Lazar, yes.
In 1989, Lazar appeared in a televised interview with investigative journalist George Knapp in Las Vegas. Lazar claimed he was hired as a physicist to work at a highly classified subterranean facility called S4, located built into a mountainside just south of Area 51.
And his claims were incredibly specific. He didn't just say, I saw UFOs. He said he was hired to reverse engineer the propulsion system of one specific craft out of nine that were parked in connected hangars. He described the craft as looking like a sport model flying saucer. But the physics he described is what the manuscript focuses on.
He described an antimatter reactor. For you listening, antimatter annihilation is the 100% efficient conversion of mass into energy. Lazar claimed this reactor was powered by a stable isotope of a super heavy element he called element 115.
Element 115.
Right. He said the element was bombarded with protons in a small particle accelerator, converting it to element 116, which immediately decayed, emitting antimatter. The resulting thermal energy was converted to electrical energy via a highly efficient thermoelectric generator, which then powered three gravity wave emitters on the bottom of the craft.
Okay, I need to explain. Like, I'm five on the gravity wave part. How does that make a ship fly?
Think of space-time like a heavy mattress. Normal propulsion pushes against the air like swimming. Lazar claimed these emitters didn't push against air. They created a localized gravitational field that basically pinched the mattress in front of the craft.
Pinched the mattress. Got it.
The craft didn't fly through space. It essentially fell forward into the distortion it created in space-time. That explains why it could make right-angle turns at thousands of miles an hour without crushing the pilot. The craft and the pilot are inside their own localized gravity bubble, insulated from inertia.
He described all of this in 1989. And he predicted element 115 14 years before scientists in Russia and the U.S. were actually able to synthesize it in a lab in 2003, which is now officially on the periodic table as muscovium.
But the massive controversy and the primary skeptical pushback is Lazar's background.
Oh, right.
Lazar claimed he earned degrees from MIT and Caltech, and that he worked as a physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. But when journalists went looking, the universities had no record of him. His employment files were missing.
But wait. If a guy says he went to MIT and worked at Los Alamos and there's no record of it, doesn't that just mean he's lying? I mean, Doesn't the whole story fall apart right there?
This raises an important question, and it's where the manuscript applies its analytical framework. Presence beats absence.
Presence beats absence.
The authors remind the reader of the biological immune system we just discussed, a system that can illegally dose its own scientists with LSD and shred the MCULTRA files, is entirely capable of wiping a civilian contractor's academic and employment history to discredit him. A missing paper trail around a classified man isn't proof of a lie. It is the fingerprint of the cover-up.
So you have to look for what they fail to erase.
Exactly. The authors point to the surviving presences. There is a physical 1982 Los Alamos National Laboratory internal phone directory that clearly lists Robert Lazar alongside the letters K/M, indicating he was a contractor for Kirk Mayer. Furthermore, there is a contemporaneous 1982 newspaper article from the Los Alamos Monitor covering a jet car Lazar built, and the very first line of the article refers to him as a physicist at the Los Alamos Meeson Physics Facility.
So the system tried to digitally unperson him, but they couldn't scrub the physical phone books and local newspapers already in circulation.
Exactly. And returning to the cost as credibility rule, what did Lazar gain from this? His life was turned upside down. He was raided by the FBI multiple times over the decades, heavily mocked by the scientific establishment, and lived under constant paranoia. Why stick to a highly specific physics lie for 40 years if it brings you nothing but misery?
Lazar was just one man in the 1980s, though. But the document argues that this isn't just one isolated story. It's a pattern of corroboration across decades. A skeptic can still dismiss Lazar as a single, eccentric anomaly. The manuscript argues that the true validation of his claims is not from his past, but from whether his highly specific physics predictions map onto modern, authenticated military encounters. Let's look at how the manuscript connects this to the 2004 Nimitz event.
The Nimitz tic-tac encounter. This is the event that forced the New York Times to cover the topic seriously in 2017 because it completely eliminated the lone crazy witness variable.
How so?
In November 2004, the USS Nimitz carrier strike group was operating off the coast of Southern California. The USS Princeton, a billion-dollar Aegis cruiser equipped with the most advanced radar system on Earth, spent days tracking anomalous objects dropping from 80,000 feet down to sea level in a matter of seconds.
Dropping 80,000 feet in seconds without generating a sonic boom and without burning up from friction, it defies our understanding of physics.
Yes. Eventually, they vectored Commander David Fravor, a highly respected TAIOPGUN graduate and squadron commander, to intercept one of the objects. Fravor, along with his wingman, visually engaged a white wingless craft shaped like a tic-tac mint, roughly 40 feet long. It had no rotors, no flight control surfaces, and no visible exhaust.
Incredible.
When Fravor descended to engage, the object actively mirrored his maneuvers, then instantaneously accelerated and vanished.
And it wasn't just human eyeballs. Later that day, another jet captured the object on an advanced infrared targeting pod. That video was eventually authenticated by the Pentagon.
The authors draw a direct line between the Tic Tac and Lazar's 1989 claims. The operational characteristics of the Tic Tac wingless, silent, lacking thermal exhaust, and moving via instantaneous acceleration perfectly match the exact mechanism of the gravity warping machine Lazar described from the inside of a hangar 15 years earlier.
You have top-tier naval sensors and aviators in 2004 validating the exact physics a ridiculed whistleblower described in 1989.
And the validation escalates dramatically when the book moves to 2023 and the testimony of David Grush. Grush wasn't just a pilot seeing something weird in the sky. He was a decorated intelligence officer. He served as the National Reconnaissance Office's representative to the Pentagon's official UAP task force.
Grush's specific job was to investigate what the intelligence community knew about UAPs. And he testified under oath to Congress that through his official duties, he discovered a multi-decade unacknowledged crash retrieval and reverse engineering program. Right.
He testified that the U.S. and its defense contractors are in possession of intact and partially intact craft of non-human origin, as well as biological evidence of the pilots. Now, skeptics immediately jumped on the fact that Grush didn't claim to have personally seen the craft.
But the manuscript points out how weak that argument is. Grush acted as a high-level investigator. He interviewed 40 firsthand witnesses who were read into these compartmented programs. He gathered the documents. That is exactly how a clearance-holding intelligence officer reconstructs an illegal, siloed-off special access program.
And crucially, Grush provided his evidence, including the names of the hostile witnesses and the locations of the facilities, to the intelligence community inspector general. The inspector general, a Senate-confirmed official, reviewed the evidence and formally deemed Grush's complaint credible and urgent.
You do not get that designation unless the underlying documentation is incredibly compelling. The book also details that the government has been officially funding studies into this exact phenomena. The existence of programs like ATIP, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, and its predecessor, AAWSOP, the Advanced Aerospace Weapon System Applications Program, is now public record. The Pentagon gave a private contractor, Bigelow Aerospace, $22 million to study these phenomena.
But AAWSA didn't just look at radar tracks. The manuscript notes that they investigated the weird stuff, including the physiological effects on witnesses who approached the craft and anomalous consciousness phenomena. And the authors connect this directly to a historical precedent, the Stargate program.
Okay, I know the moment we mentioned Stargate and remote viewing or psychic spies, a lot of you listening are probably rolling your eyes. It feels like we just took a hard left into science fiction. It triggers a profound reflex to just dismiss everything we've talked about.
The manuscript anticipates that exact reflex and unpacks a brilliant counterargument to it. It argues that the label fringe is a social verdict, not an evidentiary one. The reality is that the United States government, specifically the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the Army, literally funded the Stargate project for 20 solid years.
20 years of funding.
Yes. They studied controlled remote viewing, which is essentially the ability of the human mind to perceive distant, unseen targets or locations without using standard senses.
And they didn't do it for fun. They spent real taxpayer dollars on it because intelligence indicated the Soviets were heavily researching psychotronics, and the U.S. needed to know if it was a viable espionage tool.
Yeah.
Like, could a guy in a room in Maryland sketch the interior of a secret Soviet submarine base?
And the data suggests they could. When Congress finally commissioned an independent review of the Stargate data in 1995 to justify shutting it down, one of the primary evaluators they chose was Dr. Jessica Utz. She was a highly respected statistician who later became the president of the American Statistical Association.
That's a serious credential.
Very serious. She looked at the decades of remote viewing data under stringent laboratory conditions and concluded that the effect was statistically real. It was replicated across different laboratories, and the odds against chance were astronomically small.
A future president of the American Statistical Association stated on the record that anomalous cognition is a real, measurable phenomenon.
Exactly. The authors stress a vital epistemological rule here. Reserve your disbelief for things that are actually proven false, not just things that challenge your current materialist understanding of reality.
That's a great point.
The institutions that tell the public that remote viewing or UAPs are fringe nonsense are the exact same institutions that the first half of the book prove are entirely captured by financial incentives, protected by the black budget, and prone to manufacturing decoy narratives. You cannot rely on a captured institution to tell you what is real.
That is a massive paradigm shift. But if the physics of the tic-tac matching across decades isn't enough, the source document points to a literal first principles blueprint and an astonishing act of Congress, moving beyond witness testimony into physical science and legislation.
This brings us to a companion paper referenced in the text titled How to Build a UFO and that recent act of Congress. What makes the How to Build a UFO paper remarkable is its methodology. It does not start with Bob Lazar's claims or UFO lore. It starts with first principles in theoretical physics.
Right.
The physicist who wrote it asked a fundamental question. If you wanted to engineer a craft that manipulates a metric tensor to control gravity, what would the internal architecture of that craft naturally require?
Start from the math and build outward.
Precisely. And the paper derived several necessary components. First, it found that a gravity-controlling craft naturally requires three separate gravity emitters arranged in a triangle.
Why a triangle?
Because three is the minimum number of vectors needed to define a plane and span three-dimensional space for steering. Second, it determined the craft would need two distinct flight modes, one for hovering in an atmosphere, which they called Omicron mode, and one for rapid deep space travel called Delta mode.
And the third requirement?
The paper concluded the craft would require a highly specific, high-coupling substrate. To explain that simply a substrate is like the foundational layer of a microchip. A high coupling substrate means it is a material that is incredibly efficient at capturing and translating extreme amounts of energy without losing it to heat. You need a stable, super heavy element to generate the power required to bend space-time.
And the punchline of this entire physics exercise is that the independently derived pure math blueprint converges feature for feature with the exact schematics Bob Lazar drew on a whiteboard in 1989.
The exact schematics.
Lazar described three gravity amplifiers in a triangle on the floor of the craft. He described two flight modes, Omicron for hovering on one emitter, and Delta for pointing the bottom of the craft forward and using all three to warp space. And he described the super heavy element 115 as the fuel source. So what does this all mean?
Well, the authors argue that this convergence is the ultimate physical proof. You cannot fabricate a complex engineering schematic in 1989 that perfectly aligns with a metric tensor physics framework developed decades later. It isn't a lucky guess. The only logical explanation is that the author of the schematic was looking at a real physical machine.
It's like someone describing a futuristic smartphone in 1950. If you build one 70 years later and the internal wiring exactly matches their 1950 sketch, the person wasn't writing science fiction. They were looking at a real machine.
And the United States Congress seems to understand that this technology is real too. The manuscript points to the 2023 UAP Disclosure Act, authored by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. This wasn't a fringe bill. It was a massive bipartisan amendment attached to the National Defense Authorization Act.
And it contained a highly specific clause that attempted to assert federal eminent domain over recovered technologies of unknown origin and biological evidence of non-human intelligence.
We need to explain why eminent domain is the smoking gun here. Eminent domain is the legal process where the government forcibly seizes private property for public use. The Schumer Amendment specifically targeted material currently held by private aerospace and defense contractors.
Think about how Washington works. The Senate Majority Leader, who is briefed on the highest levels of national security, does not draft eminent domain legislation for hypothetical imaginary alien biology held by Lockheed Martin. They only draft that kind of aggressive, highly specific legal language if serious, highly cleared individuals have explicitly told them that these contractors actually possess this material in their facilities. Governments do not draft eminent domain laws for hypothetical stuff.
And what happened to that eminent domain clause? It was fiercely lobbied against behind closed doors by key lawmakers with heavy ties to the defense industry, and it was ultimately stripped out of the final bill. The manuscript flags this as the most revealing action possible. If the defense contractors do not possess crashed non-human craft, they would simply ignore the bill. You don't spend millions of dollars in political capital lobbying to kill a law that targets something you don't have.
But this brings up a massive, glaring contradiction. If this is all so real, if it's grounded in cutting-edge metric tensor physics and serious Senate eminent domain legislation, why does the public treat UFOs as a joke? Why is the internet filled with tinfoil hats, absurd conspiracies, flat earthers, and reptilian overlord theories? Why does it feel intellectually dirty to even talk about this at a dinner party?
The document has a chilling answer for that, too. The authors explain that the noise, the crazy conspiracies, the tinfoil hat stigma was intentionally manufactured. It was a psychological operation conducted by the state to protect the core secret.
How did they do it?
The keystone example they provide is the Benowitz affair from the early 1980s. Paul Benowitz was a brilliant physicist and a civilian defense contractor who lived right next to Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico. He had specialized equipment on his roof, and he started recording anomalous electromagnetic signals and weird lights over the base. He genuinely believed he was intercepting communications from an alien craft.
But he wasn't.
No. He was likely intercepting highly classified military drone or laser testing. He was a patriot, so he contacted the Air Force to warn them that he thought aliens were spying on their base. Now, in a normal world, the Air Force would just tell him to knock it off or confiscate his gear under the Espionage Act.
But they didn't do that.
No. The Air Force Office of Special Investigations dispatched an agent named Richard Doty. Doty's specific mission was to make sure Benowitz never figured out the real military secrets he was recording. So Doty, along with a compromised civilian UFO researcher, intentionally fed Benowitz elaborately fabricated UFO lore.
They fed him lies.
They gave him forged documents about a massive underground alien base in Dulce, New Mexico. They told him about secret government pacts with malevolent extraterrestrials, alien abductions, and human mutilations.
They fed a brilliant physicist a diet of absolute psychological terror. They literally drove the man insane. Benowitz spiraled into severe clinical paranoia, believed aliens were coming through his walls, and ultimately had to be institutionalized. And the most shocking part is that the agent, Richard Doty, has publicly admitted to doing this on camera in multiple documentaries since then. He admits his job was to weaponize UFO mythology to ruin a man's mind.
The manuscript uses the Benowitz affair to illuminate the overarching strategy. The government does not just issue denials, it actively manufactures state-adjacent camouflage. The fake documents that circulate the internet, like the infamous MJ-12 papers or the staged 1990s alien autopsy film.
Oh, I remember that film.
Yeah. The authors argue these are not evidence that the core UAP phenomenon is fake. They're deliberate disinformation designed to associate the real phenomena with absolute absurdity.
It is a brilliant evil strategy. If you want to discredit a highly credible whistleblower like Bob Lazar or David Grush, you don't assassinate them. That just makes them a martyr. Instead, you surround their factual claims with a circus of manufactured nonsense. You pump the ecosystem full of garbage so that no serious academic and no mainstream investigative journalist wants to touch the topic for fear of ruining their own professional reputation by association.
It creates a self-policing stigma. But the manuscript urges the reader to look at who is making the claims. The disinformation is almost always anonymous, a leaked, unsigned memo arriving in the mail, a shadowy source. But the people the authors trust, A. Ernest Fitzgerald, Philip Corso, Bob Lazar, Commander Fravor, David Grush, they put their real names, their real faces, and their actual livelihoods on the line. Cost is credibility.
Okay, let's pull all these threads together. We've mapped the accounting identity of the permanent war racket. We've looked at the consolidation of the defense primes and the F-35 political armor. We've traced the black budget immune system that destroys whistleblowers. We've examined the physics of the recovered craft and the deliberate disinformation campaigns. This brings us to the climax of the book's thesis, the ultimate motive. Why?
Why hide the greatest discovery in human history for 80 years?
Exactly. If you have technology that proves we aren't alone, why lock it in a Lockheed Martin vault?
Because of the physics we discussed earlier, a craft that can cross interstellar space or bend space-time does not burn jet fuel. It does not run on petroleum. It runs on a physics paradigm that inherently makes energy incredibly abundant, universally accessible, and cheap.
It represents a post-scarcity reality.
Yes. And you have to understand what a post-scarcity reality does to the global power structure. A post-scarcity world does not need a petrodollar. It does not need to fight endless bloody resource wars in the Middle East to secure oil reserves. It does not need to secure lithium supply chains in developing nations through military force. And, most importantly for the thesis, a post-scarcity world absolutely does not buy $2 trillion worth of F-35 fighter jets to enforce those supply chains.
The manuscript pulls the entire accounting identity together right here. And the sheer tragedy of the premise is overwhelming. Think about the ledger we discussed, the 900,000 dead, the $8 trillion spent. The young men and women dying in resource wars didn't have to die. The secret wasn't kept to protect us from a cosmic threat. It was kept to protect a balance sheet.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the manuscript's ultimate indictment. The document argues you don't even need the aliens to convict the military-industrial complex. The mundane ledger of the forever wars, the ledgers and the graves, they do that perfectly well on their own.
The decoy corruption and the F-35 prove the system is broken.
Exactly. But the recovered technology is the missing puzzle piece that explains the permanence of the war machine. The reason the wars never end, the reason the budget only ever goes up, is because the alternative, releasing the physics of free energy, would retire the conflict entirely. To release the physics is to retire the conflict. It would obsolete the defense cartels overnight.
I want you to just reflect on the world around you for a second. Think about the inflation at the grocery store. Think about the grinding resource scarcity, the constant geopolitical tension over energy pipelines. And then consider what it means if the authors of this draft are right. Consider what it means if the solution to almost all of that has been sitting on a high coupling substrate inside a contractor's hangar since the Truman administration.
It reframes the entirety of the last 80 years of human history, the Cold War, the War on Terror, the proxy wars. The manuscript suggests they were all fought in the shadow of a vault that contained the means to render every single one of those conflicts completely unnecessary.
As we wrap up this deep dive into the military-industrial complex draft, I really want to thank you for coming on this intense journey with us. Whether you fully buy into the recovered craft narrative, or if you just accept the meticulously documented financial realities of the defense sector, the text demands that we look much closer at who actually profits from state secrecy.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building on the profound implications of this source material. If the authors of this text are right, it means the greatest barrier to human evolution and a post-scarcity utopia isn't our technological capacity, and it isn't our scientific limitation, it's an accounting identity. It makes you wonder if the vault was forced open tomorrow, what would be harder for humanity to adapt to? The profound realization that we are not alone in the universe, or the horrific realization of what we've done to each other just to keep a few companies profitable?
That is a heavy, heavy question. But it is exactly the kind of question we need to be asking. So keep questioning those assumptions, keep pulling on the open threads yourself, and remember that when the institutional waters are deliberately muddied, someone is always profiting from your lack of visibility. Stay curious, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.